The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
What I think we need to be careful that is very important for the United States, though, is to make sure there is not backsliding on some of the non-economic rules, support for democracy, support for rule of law, support for the free press.
I'm David Criss.
And I'm Nate Jones. And this is the Culper Partners Rule of Law special series on the Lawfare podcast.
In this podcast series, we explore the rule of law, particularly as it relates to U.S. national security and criminal law enforcement.
Today, we're joined by John Bellinger. John is one of the country's foremost experts in international law. His career has included the private practice of law and more than a decade in the federal government as both a career official and a political appointee. From 2001 to 2005, John served in the White House under George W. Bush as legal advisor to the National Security Council and as senior associate counsel to the president. From 2005 to 2009, he served as a legal advisor to the Department of State. And in 2009, he returned to private practice at the law firm of Arnold & Porter, where he heads the firm's public international law practice.
The focus of this podcast series is the rule of law, and that applies both domestically and internationally. And there's no one better equipped to explain international law than John Bellinger. And what comes through in John's very measured remarks is a profound anguish over assaults on the rules-based international order. We in the United States largely built this system, and we have benefited enormously from it. Some critics would say we've benefited too much. And now we are tearing it down, to the delight of Russian President Putin and authoritarian leaders worldwide. It's a sobering conversation with one of America's foremost international lawyers.
It's the Lawfare Podcast, episode 424, John Bellinger on Rule of Law.
So, John, let's jump right into it. One of the phrases over the last couple of years that's been frequenting the front pages of the newspapers is the so-called liberal world order, the post-World War II order. And there's a lot packed into that phrase. I'm wondering if you could explain to listeners what that phrase means to you.
Sure. And you're right. It has been much talked about over the last few years. Lots of articles written about it. In short, the liberal international order, or sometimes called the rules-based order, refers to the set of rules, alliances, institutions, and principles developed largely by the United States with help from its allies after World War II to help manage international affairs and particularly international economic affairs. And it's based particularly in the economic area on certain principles of free trade, open markets, democracy, human rights, and leadership by the United States. And it's variously defined with certain institutions, but it would certainly include the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund, the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade. And these are both the treaties, the alliances, the international institutions that have undergirded the international economic system for the last 70 years. The conservatives sometimes more recently have found the phrase to be somewhat shadowy and conspiratorial, the idea of a international economic order Jake Sullivan, the former director of the policy planning staff at the State Department, refers to a speech he gave a few years ago in which he referred to the liberal international order out somewhere out west in the heartland, and someone came up to him and said, "I don't know what any of those three words mean, but I don't like any of them."
And can you talk a little bit briefly about what preceded the liberal world order? Why was it put into place? Why did people feel it was needed at the time?
Well, this was part of the post-World War II architecture, and there were other parts which, of course, included the United Nations and NATO. But this was really intended after World War II by the United States to knit the world together economically and also in terms of values and rule of law so that there would be open markets, free trade, and respect for democracy and human rights. And that replacing the pre-World War II system where there was less of a system, less free trade, more tariffs, more protectionism, and less democracy. And the system has been largely successful for the last 70 years in promoting economic growth, free trade, the rising of developed countries who have joined most of these institutions, lifting of people out of poverty, and spreading democracy and human rights. You know, the critics and commentators may debate whether some of that order was simply a result of the balance of power between the United States and the Soviet Union, or whether the United States was really completely responsible for the liberal international order. But certainly the time from World War II until the present has been a time largely of free trade, economic growth, and open markets. And of course, now the idea of a liberal international order has been more for the last 5 years or so, and particularly the last couple of years, more under attack both from the right and from the left.
And we want to explore some of the reasons for that attack. But I just have to ask you, in light of that reference to Jake Sullivan and his Atlantic account of that speech, I mean, is it just a branding problem? I mean, would it do better if it were referred to as the, you know, conservative nationalist chaos instead of the international, liberal international order? Is it just a branding and selling problem, or is there something more substantive going on here?
There is something more substantive going on. I mean, there are a number of critiques of the liberal international order or rules-based order, of which, only one of them is the critique from conservatives in the United States. So let me start with some of the other critiques and then get to that last one. Over time, what really has been causing more of the problem with the 70 years of a liberal international order have been challenges from the rising powers or other superpowers who've decided that they don't like U.S. leadership as much and particularly don't like the spread of democracy and human rights. And that's where we're talking about China and about Russia, who have been flexing their muscles some more. But also the growth of other authoritarian regimes who are pushing back more on U.S. leadership and free trade. Then you have and have had for two decades, a critique from the left of, this liberal international order is really just American economic hegemony. And yes, it helped the United States and a number of other Western countries to grow, but it created incredible inequities amongst countries and even winners and losers in countries like the United States. You know, and these are some of the people who go and protest outside the IMF or the World Bank. But even inside the United States, which was your point, David, is as conservatives have focused on the term liberal international order, it strikes that neuralgia that has always been present amongst, conservatives in the United States of sort of shadowy international forces beyond U.S. control. And I think, that was sort of the point of the person who spoke to Jake Sullivan is, liberal international order. Well, that sounds sort of partisan right there to begin with. Wouldn't we rather have a conservative international order? And international, well, you know, that sounds like we're giving up our nationalist sovereignty. And order, well, that's an order of what? So, you know, this gets into people who really are the idea of a liberal international order sounds like liberal elites trying to run the world. So for them, it is a branding problem. You know, these are people who don't like the United Nations, and you know, with good reason in many cases. But for them, it probably would be better to not call it the liberal international order. It would probably be better to call it the international regulatory system to protect the United States.
And John, though, it's interesting just to sort of tease out the two lines of criticism that you've just sort of set out. I mean, it strikes me that I think the folks on the conservative side and the Trump folks in particular are criticizing this system because it doesn't do enough to unilaterally benefit the United States, whereas I guess the liberal critiques that you're describing, the folks who are concerned about the hegemony, are actually thinking it does too much. I mean, is the solution to sort of get them in the room together and find the shared experience that produces the middle ground? Or is it going to just be doomed because it's being attacked from both directions for different reasons?
Well, the world has changed. And so, you know, there's been much talk literally in the last year or two, many articles written in Foreign Affairs and Foreign Policy in the Atlantic and conferences about, you know, is the liberal international order not only under siege, but, you know, facing its death? And, I think the answer to that is no, but we can't go back to just the way it used to be with the U.S. running and dominating everything. We have China, we have Russia, we have other countries who are, you know, bucking the U.S.-run system the way it used to be. So there's clearly going to have to be some changes. I don't think anybody really thinks that there's going to stop being an INF and a World Bank and trade, and that the U.S. will continue to play a leadership role in these organizations. But it's not going to be quite the way that it used to be. And so as a part of these changes to the traditional liberal international rules-based system, there will be changes that will make it more equitable around the world, take into account big countries like Russia, China, take into account economic inequities in other countries. And, you know, the U.S., particularly under the Trump administration, will be pushing more to make sure that it is fair to the United States and that it's not just a matter of sort of noblesse oblige with the U.S. taking on certain responsibilities, which, yes, have benefited us nationally, but may not have actually benefited equally all parts of the country.
And is that conversation either internationally or domestically harder to have as we get further and further away from what pre-existed the system? I guess, you know, to critique it and improve upon it, it seems to me you have to understand what it is, why it's there, and what would exist if it evaporated suddenly. Is this a failing in part of the so-called elites to keep this on the front pages and explain to people why it's important and why it's valuable?
I think to an extent, I mean, this has really been the problem on a lot of U.S. foreign policy and international policies, is to explain to a segment of the United States, and a lot of these are the base and supporters of President Trump, you know, why international engagement, international institutions, alliances, international courts, tribunals, and trade, which connect us to the rest of the world, are really a good thing. And, you know, to them, they're far away. It's sort of like the Brexit voters opposing the bureaucrats in Brussels. And for, you know, many people in the United States and the base of President Trump, it's hard to explain to them what the World Bank does or what the International Monetary Fund does or the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade. when President Trump tells them that this international system, particularly something called the liberal international order, is really benefiting them, it's hard to explain it to them. And of course, he tells them that it is slanted against the United States, that it's been unfair, that we've been sharing the burden, being the world's policeman, and allowing other countries to take advantage of us. So it's hard to go and explain that generally, and it's particularly hard to go and explain that directly to people in parts of the country who are not engaged so much in an international conversation.
Yeah. In 2017, Jack Goldsmith, somebody who you know, argued that, quote, "We are witnessing the beginnings of the greatest presidential onslaught on international law and international institutions in American history." Do you think that's a fair characterization of how the Trump administration is actually governed? And if so, where do you think those attacks are being directed specifically?
Well, for maybe 18 months or 15 months, I thought Jack had, who of course is a good friend of all of ours at Lawfare, had perhaps overstated that. There was certainly reason to be concerned. And of course, I had been one of the principal people raising concerns in 2016. But for that first year, there really was not so much a direct assault by President Trump or senior officials in the administration on international law and institutions. Certainly, the president had pulled out of the Iran deal and out of the Paris climate change agreement and threatened to pull out of NAFTA and even NATO and the UNESCO, the Human Rights Council. But it wasn't so much even a direct assault on international law and institutions. And I think part of that was, frankly, these were not of particular concerns to the president, and there were not senior officials in the administration, as there had been, unfortunately, in the Bush administration, who were really very negative about international law and international institutions. I mean, it was not something that, Mattis was probably for them. Rex Tillerson, was not against them. It was not something that H.R. McMaster, was concerned about. And, the Attorney General Sessions was focused on internal social issues. But what has happened in the last 10 months is when John Bolton took over as National Security Advisor. John, who, of course, is someone who I worked with and was his lawyer inside the State Department for a number of years, he does care deeply about these issues. He's a lawyer, and he spent a lot of time. In fact, it may be the defining aspect of his ideology is a dislike for international law, international institutions like the United Nations, and particularly international courts and tribunals. So I thought Jack might have overstated it a little bit when he wrote that a year ago, but given some of the actions of the administration, which do seem to be more directly focused on attacking international law and institutions, more recently, I am increasingly concerned that it's moved even farther over than the first term of the Bush administration.
All right, John. So I'm going to ask you to imagine an alternate universe in which President Trump calls you up and says, "John, I'm kind of an America first type of guy, and I'm surrounded now by folks who are extremely suspicious of this so-called liberal international order and the rules-based system. But I really like to expose myself to a diverse set of viewpoints so that I can make a fully informed decision based on a detailed understanding of the facts and the institutions and pros and cons involved. So tell me, John, should I keep going on this America first thing that I'm doing, pull out of NATO and just go it alone? Or, why is this liberal international order good for the United States?"
So I hope the president is asking somebody those questions. I do worry a little bit about what some of the people around him are saying in response. But I would hope that even John Bolton, who I really do know pretty well, is whispering in the president's ear that it is vitally important to stay part of NATO and our other security alliances, that the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund play important functions, and that these trade agreements, while almost everybody agrees they may need to be renegotiated in some way, provide enormous benefits for Americans by allowing for free trade and low tariffs. And presidents for several decades have said that Europeans need to spend more on their defense budgets, but that certainly doesn't mean that we should pull out of the North Atlantic Treaty. These alliances, these institutions, even the United Nations, to which John Bolton was ambassador and has famously said that he'd like to lop off the top six or seven floors of it, provide benefits to the United States. So I would hope that people, and it's certainly what I would say to President Trump if he were to ask me.
Yeah. And as part of that imaginary conversation, now to indulge it a little further, I mean, what would be the reaction inside the Kremlin if we were, say, to withdraw from NATO? I mean, you know, short of rolling tanks through the Fulda Gap or something extreme like that, is Putin going to be celebrating? And I suppose in a conversation with President Trump, who knows how it would cut. But for other people who are thinking about this, you know, can you explain a little bit what some of our adversaries or competitors would be thinking about a full expression of a U.S. go-it-alone, America-first policy and how it would benefit them?
Well, I've got to think that the Russians and President Putin are already celebrating because they've got an enormous amount. They've got the President of the United States regularly threatening NATO, threatening to pull out of NATO, threatening and attacking the European Union because he doesn't know the history of why we created a European Union, encouraging divisions inside Europe, supporting the British breakaway from the EU, and even knocking the knees out from underneath Angela Merkel so that her leadership of Europe is threatened. What I think probably the view from the Kremlin now is that, you know, contrary to what the president has suggested, which is that we're now, you know, respected around the world, is that we may have we may be the least influential that we've been in the world for a long period of time. So, you know, sure, you know, David, you served with me in the Bush administration and then had a senior official position in the Obama administration. There were things that the Europeans didn't like about the Bush administration, particularly in the first term. And there were things that particularly in the Middle East, countries didn't like about President Obama. But the U.S. was still leading and was still respected around the world. And I do think, you know, right now the U.S. has lost its leadership position and that both Russia and China are benefiting from that enormously. And of course, if it continues to further withdrawal, if the president were perish the thought, which I would hope the Senate would prevent him from doing this, would if he were to withdraw from NATO or to continue to attack our European allies, of course, that's just further music to the ears of President Putin and his friends in the Kremlin.
Yeah. All right. So then let's talk treaties. I mean, generally speaking, why should Americans think that treaties are good for the U.S.? What do they do for us as a general matter?
Well, of course, not every treaty is good for the U.S. The U.S. enters into, you know, lots of international agreements, you know, hundreds every year. Most of them are actually done as executive agreements, which is an international agreement that doesn't have to go to the Senate. And certain international agreements rise to a certain level that they have to be approved by the Senate, and those are called treaties. And there are lots of international agreements and treaties that are negotiated by other countries that the United States has not joined because we don't think that they're in our interest. But there are many over time, and we're party to several thousand, that are very much in our interest and benefit Americans, individual Americans, every single day. And so that's been the job of each administration, particularly the State Department, to determine which treaties we want to join or help negotiate. And then if we're satisfied with the negotiation at the end, do we want to end up joining them? So, of course, it varies. Not they're good treaties and they're bad treaties. But I gave a speech a few years ago to the National Association of Attorneys General about how they benefit from treaties every day. I think they were probably a little surprised to see me on the agenda. Why is the State Department legal advisor talking to the attorneys general of the different states? And by about halfway through the talk, I probably covering their ears, maybe for because they didn't want to listen to me anymore, but in part because I had told them so many treaties which benefited their citizens every day, such as, you know, the mutual legal assistance treaties that allow their prosecutors to ask for information about crimes that have been committed in their states from other countries. The child abduction treaty that allows children who've been abducted to be returned. One of my favorites is the Road Traffic Convention, which allows citizens of parties to the Road Traffic Convention to drive on each other's roads without having to go and get a driver's license of that country. The Chicago Convention, which is the treaty that allows us to fly over each other's countries. So, you know, you hear conservatives sometimes say, well, we shouldn't join a treaty that's giving up our sovereignty. Well, you know, if we didn't give up our sovereignty to allow countries to fly airplanes over our territory, they wouldn't allow us to fly over their territory. And it would take a long time to get places by ship or to go through, you know, dog legs over other countries. So, you know, there may be some bad treaties, which, you know, we hope we haven't signed up to. But I can give you a very long list of treaties that, you know, we enter into with other countries so that we can get them to give benefits not only to us as a country, but to individual Americans.
John, that was great. I love the list. And what about trying to group treaties then to get a little more refined? I mean, are bilateral treaties always superior to multilateral? Are multilateral always worse for the United States? Or is it more of a mixed bag that just depends, as you said, on the particular content?
It is a mixed bag. And, you know, a bilateral treaty, of course, is a treaty just with one other country. Multilateral treaties are treaties with a lot of countries, sometimes with hundreds or even, you know, 190 countries. We got a few treaties like the Geneva Conventions or the Vienna Convention on Diplomatic Relations, to which almost every country in the world is a treaty. The problem, and this is what you hear from the Trump administration with multilateral treaties, is it's like going out to the movies with people. If you try to, you know, just negotiate with your wife about what movie to go to, it's hopefully not too hard.
It's really easy. We just go to the movie that she wants to go to.
But, you know, to try to get, you know, 50 of your friends to agree on a movie, you know, it takes quite a long time to get done. And so you get watered down to the lowest common denominator. But, you know, there are going to be certain treaties, you know, that hopefully nobody is going to think it makes sense to negotiate 190 individual Chicago conventions that, okay, I can fly over Germany. Okay, I can fly over Italy. Okay, I can fly over Russia. And the same with the Road Traffic Convention. So, yeah, multilateral treaties are inherently more complex. They do get watered down. And sometimes they get watered down so much that the U.S. walks away from them. We tend to be very tough negotiators on treaties. But, you know, some are inherently lend themselves to being a bilateral treaty, like an extradition treaty with, you know, a particular country, or a mutual legal assistance treaty with a particular country. But others on topics of common concern, and you know, this seems to be something that at least, you know, some people in the Trump administration don't understand, is that, you know, there are issues of common concern. You know, you're not going to have 194 different bilateral terrorism conventions or cyber conventions. This is something where you're going to want to do it multilaterally and get all countries in the world to try to sign up to a common standard. And that's where the U.S. needs to try to keep that standard at a high level.
without an enforcement mechanism, or at least direct enforcement like you have domestically with legal rules and norms sometimes, how do you evaluate whether it makes sense to enter into some of these things without a great deal of confidence about whether the other party or parties are going to follow those rules?
Well, that's almost always the conservative critique of international law. And I even got that from my father, now dead, from time to time, who sort of scoffed at international law, you know, of, well, is it really law? You know, there's no enforcement. It's really just all politics or policy. And, you know, the answer is international law can be difficult to enforce. There are mechanisms to do it. And you have to have dispute resolution mechanisms that countries will then abide by. So the dispute resolution mechanisms are defined in individual treaties. It may be an arbitration. Countries may agree to submit their disputes to the ICJ, the International Court of Justice in The Hague. Of course, if the International Court of Justice in The Hague rules against you, then, you know, some countries, including the United States, occasionally have just ignored what the ICJ has to say. The ICJ, of course, does not have marshals to go out and force countries to do things. It's turned over to the Security Council, which, because of the veto-wielding members on the Security Council, can ultimately block enforcement. But so at the end of the day, it can be very difficult to enforce certain provisions of international law. But there are ways to do it by either, you know, getting countries to abide by a International Court of Justice ruling, or ultimately getting the Security Council to direct them to do something. So, yes, enforcement of international law has always been the issue, but that doesn't mean that one shouldn't try, because otherwise, you know, they're really, and this gets back to your very first questions to me, of the international rules-based system. Otherwise, you essentially have a Hobbesian state of nature with every country sort of, you know, doing what they want and getting into fights or wars or worse.
So is it fair to say that despite the difficulties of enforcement, it's easier to enforce when those rules exist than when they're absent?
Yes, absolutely. And so the criticism that, well, is international law really real and is it enforceable and do countries follow it? Those are real concerns. But, you know, I would rather have rules that people have signed up to and then try to, as the United States, force them or cajole them or embarrass them or pressure them or sanction them into complying, rather than simply having no rules at all. You can't really very well accuse somebody of bad behavior or violating the rules, you know, if there are no rules. So, you know, let me take, you know, one of the most important treaties that we at the State Department observe, and it's literally largely observed by everybody around the world, is the Vienna Convention on Diplomatic Relations, which provides immunity to diplomats and immunity to their families and to their embassies. You know, if we didn't have that treaty, you know, people would be kidnapping, killing people's diplomats, breaking into their embassies all the time. Now, that doesn't mean that that never happens. Bad countries will sometimes grab people's diplomats. The Iranians did that to us in 1979, broke into our embassy. You know, we sued them before the ICJ. We won. The Iranians ignored that. But, you know, we ultimately, it was better to have had the rule that most countries abide by and then to be able to accuse the Iranians of breaking those clear rules that every country in the world agreed to, and ultimately the ICJ ruled against them as well, than to have no rules at all.
Mm-hmm. So, John, another crack at sorting treaties by category. You mentioned earlier some of them go through U.S. Senate approval process and others are just executive level agreements. The Obama administration certainly took advantage of the latter type of treaty. Do you have a view on the relative pros and cons of those?
Yeah. So what we're seeing, and this is sort of, you know, as much talked about as the decline of the liberal international order, is the decline of the treaties approved by the Senate. And so it's getting harder and harder to get treaties approved by the Senate. Just to give you a couple of statistics, which people may find interesting, over the last 20 years. So during the 8 years of the Bush administration, in which I served and you served for part of it, we got 163 treaties through the Senate, approved by the Senate. That's probably more treaties in an eight-year presidency than at any point in American history. And those were bilateral, multilateral, over a variety of different subjects, human rights, terrorism, arms control, environmental, extradition, you name it. 163 treaties between 2001 and 2009. In the Obama administration, there were only 20 treaties approved by the Senate, perhaps the fewest number in an eight-year period, certainly in the last 100 years. And in the Trump administration, only six treaties have been approved by the Senate in the last 2 years. So you can see 163 to 20 to 6, you know, we're going way down. There are a number of reasons for that, but the Senate has been growing increasingly more conservative and suspicious of treaties and just hasn't been approving even basic treaties that no one used to object to, like extradition or tax treaties. So as a result, particularly on bigger agreements like the Iran deal or Paris climate change, the Obama administration, realizing that it was not going to be able to get, you know, a big agreement with Iran or a big agreement with the rest of the world on climate through as a treaty, negotiated them. The deal with Iran, they was not even an international agreement. They called it an international arrangement. It was basically a big political declaration that said, you know, if you do the following things, we'll do the following things. But it didn't have any of the famous words that we international lawyers use and consider to be binding: shall, we shall, or you shall. And that's because there was concern that the president or that the Senate would not approve those treaties. So, you know, it's a big question as to whether, you know, we really have seen, as Ona Hathaway at Yale wrote a couple of years ago, the death of treaties, and whether as a result future presidents will, to the extent they want to enter into a significant or binding international agreement with another country, try to do it either as an executive agreement that doesn't require approval by the Senate, or even as something fuzzier, such as the Iran deal, which was an arrangement.
Yeah. So do you think, I mean, not to put you on the spot, so feel free to, you know, move sideways on this, but was it a mistake for the Obama administration to do Paris and Iran without going to the Senate? Or do you think they had to do it, given that the Republicans in the Senate were just not going to be supportive of maybe any international treaty of substance, let alone those particular ones?
I think they had to do it that way. It was clear that those were not going to be approved as a, well, the Iran deal was not going to be approved as a treaty. And again, it was not legally binding. So, you know, it can be criticized as bad policy, but it was not something that had to be submitted to the Senate because it wasn't legally binding. It was, you know, we entered into political declarations with other countries pretty regularly where we say, you know, we will do something or you will do something. So, no, I don't think that was a mistake. I think, you know, there may have been more that the administration could have done with both of those agreements / arrangements to try as best they could to get more of the Congress on board with what they were doing, so it didn't appear quite so unilateral. I mean, as you know, that was a problem that many conservatives had in the Senate, in particular with President Obama, even though he'd been a senator, you know, was, you know, his desire to do things unilaterally by executive order, you know, without involving the Congress, and that really did infuriate them. So I think, you know, more consultation is always better.
Let's talk a little bit about U.S. adherence to some of these rules. And I guess specifically, let's talk about one of the more consequential activities nation states engage in, and that's the use of force. All three of us have been part of this policymaking process in different administrations. Can you talk a little bit about whether the U.S. really tries to abide by the legal constraints imposed on it by the international system in that regard? How it goes about evaluating those things and whether it's something they should be doing, abiding by them?
Well, let's certainly I think that it's hard for me as a former legal advisor to the State Department to say they shouldn't be abiding by them.
It was a leading question.
And of course, you know, we have both the domestic rules on use of force, which is the Constitution and the Congress's powers under the to declare war and the president's powers as commander in chief. Those are shared. And then the War Powers Resolution. And then we have the international rules on use of force, which basically say you can't use force in another country unless it's in self-defense or unless the country consents or unless the Security Council provides authorization. Presidents for the last several decades have been spotty on complying with both domestic and international rules. Let's do international first. I think the lawyers in the different administrations try hard to have the president and the senior leaders comply with international law as best they can, because they, being the legal experts, realize that if the United States doesn't comply with the international law rules, it's very hard to criticize any other country if it doesn't comply with international law rules. Unfortunately, you know, in many administrations, including, you know, the first term of the Bush administration in which I served, it could be very hard to convince, you know, senior leaders that these international law rules are important. Again, we've talked about the fact that they're just not really viewed as law at all, and the reciprocity argument doesn't always work very well, you know, to say, well, if we don't follow the rules, then others won't follow the rules. You know, the response to that is usually, well, we just need to do what's in our interest. My sense was that, you know, President Obama, and David, you, of course, served in that administration in a senior position, you know, that was a bit more of government by lawyers. You know, the president was a lawyer, the vice president was a lawyer, the secretary of state was a lawyer, obviously the attorney general was a lawyer. And so in considering use of force as an international law matter, you know, that there was at least a lot of discussion of the issues and awareness. Now, in some ways, oddly, and this may be viewed as more of a partisan comment, when it comes to domestic law on use of force, I felt that President Obama actually stretched the rules more than President Bush, because President Bush actually got authorizations to use force for both the terrorism actions after 9/11 and for the Iraq War, whereas President Obama did not have an authorization for use of force in Libya and pretty much blew through the War Powers Resolution with an odd interpretation that those were not really hostilities in Libya. And then for the war with ISIS, although probably, you know, most people supported it as a matter of policy, he didn't get a new AUMF and instead took a pretty strained interpretation to say that ISIS really was just the descendant of al-Qaeda. So, you know, I think in that case, the Obama administration, you know, they took the war powers issues very seriously, but got boxed in as a matter of domestic law, which left them, you know, with no alternatives or very few good alternatives in both Libya and with respect to ISIS. So all of that is by way of saying, I think, you know, what I can say with authority, at least in both the Obama and Bush administrations, is that, you know, these use of force issues as a matter of both domestic and international law were taken extremely seriously by the lawyers, pretty seriously by the principals, but, you know, a harder sell, I think, in Republican administrations with respect to international law rules on use of force. And then in this administration, you know, it's really hard to tell. With respect to the two uses of force against Syria, with respect to chemical weapons, you know, there was no effort to try to explain those actions as to why they were justified under international law. On the other hand, it would have been very difficult to do so because they probably were not lawful under international law.
Let me ask you about something you alluded to a bit earlier, and that's Congress's role in some of these things, at least in the domestic side of this conversation. I have to admit, I was involved in a number of the Obama administration discussions on this front at the NSC, and I'm wondering, you know, similar to with the Iran deal, if the Senate and the House don't play a constructive role in this process, what choices is the president left with? Is part of this problem a congressional problem?
You're exactly right. That, of course, has really been the problem with the AUMFs on terrorism and on Libya, but particularly with respect to a new AUMF to replace the 2001 authorization, either to use force against ISIS or just against other terrorist groups. And if Congress just won't go along, it really makes the president's job very difficult. It leaves one with the choice of either, I mean, because then you bump up against the War Powers Resolution as well, which is you start using force, but you can only do it for 60 days unless there's an authorization. And it leaves a president with the choice of either stopping the use of force, which often if it's something like ISIS or even in Libya, a president is not going to want to do, or blowing through the War Powers Resolution and saying that it is somehow unconstitutional as applied, which I think at least Democratic administrations have not wanted to do that because it would be a big deal, or to stretch and strain to reinterpret the authorities to say, well, you know, it really was authorized by Congress or it was not really a use of force. And that's what President Obama did, both with respect to his use of force in Libya and against ISIS. So, you know, I will often say, despite, you know, sounding somewhat critical, that, you know, if I were NSC legal advisor in those circumstances, and I've talked to, you know, Neil Eggleston about this, it's, you know, I don't know what I would have done. And that, you know, certainly with respect to ISIS, the president was not going to say, throw up his hands and say, well, you know, Congress is just not going to vote a new authorization, so I'm going to just stop. You know, he ended up taking a very strained interpretation of the 2001 AUMF, but it's only because Congress would not do their jobs.
Right. And of course, Congress is aware of all that and loving it, probably at least in part. So, John, let's sort of do a last segment here by widening out the aperture a little bit. I hope we're not taking a liberty if we mark you down as generally supportive of the liberal international order. But let's talk about its future. First of all, what can the U.S., what should the U.S. be doing to preserve the best parts of this system? And related to that, how is the system equipped to deal with some of the major international challenges of the future, for example, cyberspace, climate change, and the like? What do you think about that?
So, well, let me break that apart. So certainly there do need to be reforms of the trade relations, and that's, although I don't think most people would go about doing it the way President Trump is doing it, by, you know, threatening to pull out of all of our trade agreements and, you know, jacking up the tariffs. You know, there are reforms that need to be made, and there are reforms to the WTO, to the tariff system, and to international trade relations that need to be made. And although this is not really my area of expertise, there may be changes that may need to be made to broaden the governance of the system so that you know, more people are involved. So that's, we can't just go backwards. We need to recognize the changes in the world and make changes to that, you know, the rules-based system. What I think we need to be careful that is very important for the United States, though, is to make sure there is not backsliding on some of the non-economic rules, support for democracy, support for rule of law, support for the free press. All of those things are now, those are part of the liberal international order, and the United States has supported those values around the world through both democratic and Republican administrations, whether they're called human rights or democracy or just rule of law. That is part of the liberal international order, and we have supported that around the world. Those values are now under attack around the world, and the U.S. is doing little about it, and they're under attack at home, and we're doing little about it. So, you know, we sadly, you know, the president of the United States attacks the press at home. He attacks the independent judiciary and has not been trying to spread these or promote these values or even to serve really as a city on a hill for the rest of the world. And that's a real change. So we need to shore up our democracy at home so that we can then continue to promote those values around the world. Interestingly, the national security strategy, which came out in December a year ago, although I think it only mentions the words human rights once, it does talk about American values. I frankly think that's sort of suggesting that the values of democracy and rule of law are only American values and are not values that, you know, we should share around the world. But it did say that the United States would continue to stand for those values. Interestingly, it didn't say that the United States, as part of its national security strategy, would try to continue to promote those values. And in fact, you know, we have not seen much of that in the Trump administration. And, you know, candidly, this is something that has puzzled me a little bit, Nate and David, because I would like to think that every American, you know, whether supporting President Trump or not, you know, believes in these same values that are enshrined in our Constitution about, you know, freedom of the press and independent judiciary, rule of law, due process, and that, you know, they're important at home and that they ought to be important around the world. So there ought to be things that, you know, we all ought to be able to stand behind. And so those, that is an important part of the liberal international order that is under attack around the world. And the, you know, concerns me as an international lawyer that the United States is you know, shrunk back from its traditional role of promoting those values around the world. So I think that is something that we need to all get behind.
Yeah. Well, John, I think what you said about putting our own house in order on those fronts is particularly relevant to that last observation about our role in the international community and our leadership there. But I think we're going to leave it there. And thank you very much for your time with us today.
Thank you all both. And thanks for what you all are doing with this great series of podcasts. Keep up the good work.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Thanks this week to John Bellinger for coming on the show. If you haven't yet, please take a second to share the Lawfare Podcast on social media and give us a 5-star rating and review wherever you found us. You can also now purchase Lawfare swag at our online store, www.thelawfarestore.com. The podcast is edited by Jen Patya Howell, and our music is performed by Sophia Yam. As always, thanks for listening.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.